Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous Fireside Room, today's speaker is David Lund, and he will be speaking on The Way of Torah. So let's listen in on David Lund.
My name is David Lund, and I'm from Seattle, and I am a Lutheran parish pastor there, and I'm quite involved with Jewish-Christian relations in Seattle. Different seminars, discussion groups. Usually I teach a course like this with a rabbi who's a friend of mine, who unfortunately wasn't able to come up here this week. He had hoped to, but he couldn't. So you get me. There is a counterpart that I have designed for you of some Jewish voices, but unfortunately they're only in the form of a couple books that are for sale in the bookstore, if you like. If they run out, maybe you could borrow one or the other from someone who has one. You could talk to one another about who has got one. They're reasonably priced. This is the very best introduction to Judaism that I think you'll find. It's called The 9 Questions People Ask About Judaism. It's written by a rabbi and a Jewish layman. And the other book is called, and in the bookstore, it's in paperback, it's blue and white, it's called Why the Jews, the Reason for Anti-Semitism. So they're there, and the same authors, by the way. And this is about $9, and this is $12 or something like that. They're pretty reasonably priced. And they will complement the discussions that we have in here. And be good, they're a very good reference for when you go home to have with you. Yesterday, we talked about God. We talked about monotheism. How many of you were here yesterday? Let's see, a whole bunch of you. Yeah, okay. We talked about monotheism. Those of you who weren't here, if you want to get filled in on monotheism, talk to somebody who just raised their hand over lunch or something. This discussion goes on and it'll be very delightful. Today we're going to start talking about the Torah. We'll talk a little bit about why I use that word all the time, Torah, and what it means. And then starting on Friday, we'll talk about, actually no, starting tomorrow and continuing into Friday, we'll talk about Israel. And these are basically the three, you can call them three pillars, or three, I don't know, pillars is good enough. Some people call it the Jewish Trinity, kind of a funny way to talk about it. But those are the three main foundations or pillars of Judaism, and Jews adhere to at least one of these three pillars. Jews are either concerned with the one God, the God of Israel, or with the Torah, which we'll talk about today, or with Israel. Some Jews are concerned with two out of those three, and some with all three. But there's a diversity in the Jewish community about that. For example, there are people who are very involved with the state of Israel and support for it who are atheists. And at the same time, there are people who are very pious, Jews who follow the Torah meticulously, who aren't very concerned about Israel at all, at least the state. They're concerned about the people of Israel, but not necessarily the state of Israel. See, it's just kind of a distraction. So, those are the three main things, and today we're going to talk about Torah. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to give you information for about 25 to 30 minutes, and then I'd like to have a discussion among ourselves. And if you have something to write with, and you have a question, please feel free to write it down, and I promise you I'll answer it as best I can. All right. This is the material I'll be working is starting on page 2 in the middle, where it says Torah. The word Torah is a Hebrew word that is a very important word. It actually means teacher. It's from the root of the verb to teach. It means teacher or teaching. It also means instruction. You can translate it that way. Does anybody know how the word Torah has traditionally been translated into English?
No.
With the word law. Now that I've told you that Torah really means teacher or instruction, what is odd about translating it law, or what might be problematic?
It's more like rules.
Okay, law implies rules, restrictions,
authority.
Authority,
limitation,
conformity. Good. How about teacher or instructor or instruction? Is that, what does that imply?
It helps me grow.
You can start the tape, by the way, if you haven't already.
Guidance.
Yeah, growth.
Oh, I like that.
Dialogue.
Conversation. Dialogue. A teacher doesn't just lecture. Hopefully facilitates a conversation. You see the real difference? And you start to understand why I prefer not to use the word law at all in this context? Just to say Torah and explain to you what the Torah is? It's very unfortunate. What law has come to mean in our society has very little to do with the spirit of Torah. And that's what I'll try to argue today. Well, what is the... Well, a couple of other things here. There are a couple different meanings of the word Torah. On the one hand, the Torah is the Hebrew scripture, the Bible of Israel. Like often if Jews talk about the Torah, they mean the Bible. Some construe it to mean more strictly just the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. However, the word Torah also has another meaning, referring directly to commandments, ordinances, and statutes. That's the language of Deuteronomy, commandments, statutes, ordinances. And that means the teachings or the commandments from Sinai, from the middle of Exodus through the middle of Numbers. That whole body of commandment, statute, ordinance that is given at Sinai to the people. Now, in Judaism, there are two kinds of Torah. There is written Torah and oral Torah. So there's the written Torah that is defined in the Bible, but there's also the oral Torah. And that is the Torah that was given orally to Moses in Jewish tradition. So you've got written Torah and oral Torah. And the oral is remembered in tradition, and it's used to interpret the written Torah and vice versa. So there's two streams, so to speak. That opens up some avenues, I think, for seeing that Torah, if anything, is not legalistic. Because there's even another source of Torah apart from the written Torah. At any rate, those are some definitions. So let's go. What's the purpose of Torah? The purpose is to promote compassion, loving kindness, and peace in the world. And that's a quote from Maimonides, the greatest Jewish scholar and thinker in history, who lived in the Middle Ages in Cairo, of all places. The word halakha, means the way. And halakha is the word that is used for interpretation of Torah, for seeking to live according to faithfulness to the Torah. It's the way. It means like a road. It's a means, not an end. And the ultimate goal, of course, of Torah is to improve the world under the rule of God. Tikkun olam. All right, what is the goal of Torah? Well, the goal is A, to produce people as good as humanly possible. B, to become holy, for Israel to become holy, to become different, odd, distinct, set apart among the other peoples of the world. And C, to keep Israel and its mission alive. So Torah also deals with the future and the vitality of the people so that Israel will continue to exist and be able to fulfill its mission. We talked about that yesterday, that mission that is the third part of the covenant with Abraham. Third, Torah is very pragmatic. It's very realistic. It's very skeptical. As I am prone to say, Judaism is a very behavioral religion. It's very different from Christianity that way. It is not centered or based in doctrines or beliefs or sort of intellectual propositions. It is a very behavioral way of life. It has to do with obedience, with shape of life in personally and in family and in community. Judaism is based on a very realistic view of human nature. In other words, the rabbis had a deep distrust of human nature and tendencies, and therefore saw the need to be concerned about the laws, the discipline involved in being faithful to God. The contention of classical Judaism is that, with rare exceptions, all people need a system of some kind of laws, of ethics, and a community to be accountable. In other words, people on their own will not be ethical and will not do the good rather than and shun the evil, but that there is guidance necessary and a community to which one is accountable. Moral ideals are not sufficient without a detailed moral or ethical system binding on all individual members to achieve peace, justice, and brotherhood. That's why Torah is always addressed to Israel as a whole, never to individuals. It's to all the people. The sense is that to be faithful to God, Israel needs to have a common project. And they need to all be on the same page, as we would say today, on the same wavelength. And the analogy that I use is, no one can learn a sport or an instrument without discipline, without training, without rules, without guidance, without accountability. It's just impossible to really become proficient at sport or some kind of music making. So why do we think that people can learn goodness without such a system of discipline, training, guidance, mentors, and accountability? Goodness is just as difficult to learn as piano. More difficult, probably. Sometimes I talk to parents of young people in my congregation, I say, you know, I want you to think about the fact that parents in our culture today spend much more time and money and energy developing their children's athletic ability, musical ability, spend very little time, money, and energy with working on their children's character. I mean, it's hard to create a good and form a good doctor or a good lawyer or a good musician. But you know what's really difficult is to form a good person. It doesn't just happen. And that's the contention of Torah. That there needs to be some kind of a framework by which people actually learn to do the good. I'm going to read to you something. I talked to you about how Judaism is not a religion based on doctrines or beliefs, but rather based on a community with a particular lifestyle or way of life together. And I'm going to read you something that William Scott Green wrote. He was thinking about the world that we live in, the world of Protestantism in America. And this is, he basically describes the dichotomy or the difference between liberal Protestantism and something like Judaism. He says, the basic attitude of mind characteristic of the Protestant study of religion holds that religion is certainly in your soul, likely in your heart, perhaps in your mind, but never in your body. That attitude encourages us to construe religion cerebrally and individually, to think in terms of beliefs and the believer, rather than in terms of behavior and community. The lens provided by this prejudice draws our attention to the intense and obsessive belief called faith. So religion is understood as a state of mind, the object of intellectual or emotional commitment, the result of decisions to believe or to have faith. According to this model, people have religion, but they do not do their religion. Thus, we tend to devalue behavior and performance, to make it I don't want to say this word because I don't even know what it means, really. to make behavior sort of a sideline, and of course, to emphasize thinking and reflecting the practice of theology as the primary activity of religious people. Does that sound familiar to you? Okay. Judaism is very different. Does not emphasize intellectual activity as the primary activity of people, or even inner experience in the heart. It emphasizes actions. It emphasizes behavior and the shaping of people and of the community. Okay, Torah law is different from secular law in that secular law can only legislate against evil generally. In other words, law in our culture in America generally legislates only against evil. It says things that you cannot do and for which you will be punished. But only religious law can legislate goodness, that you actively pursue the good. In Deuteronomy it says, justice, justice, you shall pursue. There's this active sense of creating a way for people to pursue goodness, not just to avoid evil. See, the example is, the classical story of in a big city of a woman being attacked and screaming and no one coming to her aid. In our culture, nobody is criminally liable for not coming to her aid, right? But under a system like Torah, they would be for not helping. Not helping is seen as wrong, just as wrong, in fact, as doing evil. Not helping someone to resist evil. Okay, the interesting thing is, in the system of Torah, is that much less is expected of non-Jews. Anyone watch Schindler's List? He was declared a righteous Gentile. A Gentile who has a share in the world to come. Well, did he observe commandments very much? I mean, he was not the greatest example of morality in the world. Okay? But in Judaism, for non-Jews, the requirements to be righteous are actually much less stringent. Anyone ever heard of the basic seven laws of the children of Noah, of tradition? The idea that seven basic laws were given to Noah and his descendants, which means the whole human race. They're really simple. A, not to deny God, not to do idolatry. 2, not to blaspheme. 3, not to murder. 4, not to engage in unholy sexual relations. 5, not to steal. 6, not to eat the limb of a living animal. And 7, to set up and maintain courts of justice to ensure obedience to the above 6 laws. That's it for non-Jews. Interesting, huh? All right. Well, and so all things that tend towards ethics, towards increasing goodness in the world, receives Jews' support. Even though for Israel itself, there's a much higher standard and many more commandments and so forth. Well, let's talk about God's strategy as we look through the Bible. In the beginning, it seems that Cain had a conscience. It seems like after he murdered his brother, when God came to him and said, where's your brother? He didn't just say, what? He made a smart aleck remark. He says, am I my brother's keeper? Which shows right there that he knew he had done something wrong. He did have a conscience. Later he expects that he'll be killed for what he's done. So he has that sense. Conscience is there. But as we go through, conscience isn't enough. Wickedness spreads, the flood wipes out the earth. And now, after the flood, after Noah and his family emerged from the ark, God begins to give commandments. It's almost as if God realized conscience isn't enough to stop people from murdering each other. They need commandments. They need some laws. And they need somehow to be accountable to a higher power to obey those laws. Well, that didn't work either, because we come to chapter 11, and after the flood and after those commandments, and we have the Babel story where human evil is out of control again. So finally, what does God do? God calls Abraham, and therefore a people. Later on, rescues the people out of slavery in Egypt and takes them to a mountain. And they sit there for a long time. And God gives them commandments, statutes, and ordinances. A lot of them. And says, by you being my holy people and living according to these, to this Torah, you will actually affect and bless all the other peoples in the earth. So it's almost as if God realizes as time goes on that commandments are necessary. And that accountability in a holy community is really necessary. Otherwise, literally, people are going to kill each other off. That's the sense you get, anyway. Okay, well, so what we do is we look at Sinai, and we see Israel being given the Torah, and we see them then being sent out from the mountain, sent out from Sinai with a mission. With a mission, a very challenging mission, a very difficult one, to indeed live this life that God has called them to, and to create the kind of a community that has the goodness to go out there and literally touch the world. All right. There are four kinds of Torah law. I'm going to do this very quickly. There are four basic kinds of Torah law, and any law in the Torah, here I am using the word law again, I can't avoid it, I'm sorry, but you know what I mean. Any command, statute, ordinance, any law in the Torah can be described in one of these four ways, at least one. First is reflexive laws, laws that affect the doer of the law. Okay? And the contention here is that our deeds influence our values much more than our values influence our deeds. The idea that what we do actually shapes us as people, and we're more prone to do it in the future. That's the whole way of thinking about our character. So, the primary example of reflexive law is prayer in Hebrew. The Hebrew word for prayer means to examine oneself. It's a reflexive verb. It means to examine oneself. And the main commandment for prayer is for the way that it affects you, the prayer. I mean, Judaism knows that God is self-sufficient, that God is transcendent, that God is almighty. God doesn't need anyone's prayer to do anything. God's will is done without our prayer, as Luther says in the Catechism, even. Luther picks up on that. But what it does is it affects the one praying. Okay? So that's a reflexive kind of law. Another example is the command to wear the tzitzit, the fringes on the garment. Anybody know what those are for? Fringes on the garment are to remind you of the commandments and of the call to goodness and to obedience that God has called. There's a fun story. Anyone ever seen the fringes on the garment among observant Jews who keep such laws? There's this fun story that kind of illustrates it of a young Jewish boy who's grown up and he's starting to, feel his sexual desires. And what he does is he gets out of the town where he lives, so nobody will know, goes to another town where he's totally anonymous, and he meets a young woman who happens to be a prostitute. And he's about to do what one does with prostitute. And there's a story that says that his tzitzit, his fringes, come up and smack him in the face. And, basically remind him, as he starts to take off his clothes, smack him in the face and remind him of who he is and to whom he belongs. And the call that he has been given in terms of his behavior. And so the story has kind of a funny end. The whore asks, what happened, what, and he explains the fringes, and she converts and becomes and marries him. Anyway, it's a funny story, but you see the whole idea of this commandment to have fringes. It affects you. It affects you. It doesn't affect anybody else, really. Okay, the second kind of law is laws of ethics, and those are laws that deal with relations between people to ensure moral treatment of others. For example, the last six of the Ten Commandments. are all about the neighbor. They're all about how to treat the neighbor. They're specific. The Torah doesn't just say, be good and do good. It becomes very specific. It says, do the following. I gave you some examples. The laws of tzedakah, or charity, which calls Israel, members of Israel, to give the tithe. It's not always 10%, but that's the goal. That's a law that deals with ethical treatment of other people, namely the poor. Laws against gossip. Gossip is called a law that is equivalent with murder, as serious as murder, because it's one of those sins that cannot be undone, cannot be made right again, just like murder, see? You can't make that right because the one that you'd make it right to is dead. And in gossip, once it's done, you can't undo it. That's another ethical law. The shopkeeper law I find very interesting. You see, Torah law is real specific. It gets real down into the nitty-gritty of life. And I find it rather refreshing that the shopkeeper law says when you go into a store, you cannot ask the shopkeeper the price of an item unless you intend to buy it. How come? Well, the traditional explanation is that if you ask the price, you raise the hopes of the shopkeeper that you're going to buy that item. And if you don't intend to buy it, it's unfair and wrong to raise the person's hopes. Now again, we're probably thinking of an ancient society where every sale mattered to a shopkeeper for his or her existence. But again, you see, that's an ethical law. That's a law about relations between people. A law that gives a little more dignity and a little more grace to life together. All right. Treatment of animals. Nothing moves me as much as the law that you have to feed your animals first on the Sabbath. And you can't make them work. Now, you say, why is that an ethical law? Well, because I think the rationale of it is to treat... If people learn to treat animals ethically, they'll probably treat people ethically. It's the reason some of us have our children have pets. Right? Kind of as training. All right? And of course, there are many, many Torah laws about treatment of the weak in the community and of the elderly, of older parents, and of course, of the poor, and exiled, resident aliens, foreigners, etc. All right, laws of holiness, the third kind of law. These are not laws between people. They're not ethical laws. They're laws between people and God, between the believer and God. And a good definition, a classical definition of holiness laws, are all laws that elevate actions from the animal life to a higher level. So, it's not a surprise when you find in Leviticus and the holiness codes that most holiness laws deal with activities that humans share with animals. Primarily eating and sex. The two biggest areas where people share with animals. And those are the areas that holiness laws are most occupied with, not only, but mostly, to elevate human life, human eating, and human sexual behavior above the animal life. Okay? So, holy, what does holy mean? In Leviticus 19 it says, "You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." Holy means different. It means set apart, distinct. I mean, today the word holy means kind of, you know, kind of glow or something. But that isn't the original meaning of the word holy. Holy simply means if I took the five of you over here and cordoned you off from the rest, I would be making you holy. I'd be sanctifying you. It just means setting apart, making you different. Okay? And laws of holiness are about human life different. And especially the life of Israel. Okay? The contention is, again, that humans instinctively or naturally would act like animals. So, the Torah doesn't denigrate these activities, but it elevates them or sanctifies them. For example, if you eat like an animal, you know, if you eat with your hands or with your mouth directly, that's not unethical, is it? But there are Torah laws about eating. But it doesn't hurt your neighbor to eat that way, does it? Okay? So it's a law of holiness. It's not unethical to eat like a pig. It's unholy.
Okay.
So the laws about washing and about dishes and all the stuff that elevate and bring great dignity and grace to eating, especially on the Sabbath. How about sexuality? It's perfectly possible for people to have sexual relations like a rabbit. And, you know, some do. Okay. But sexual laws emphasize things like faithfulness, chastity, abstaining from sex during certain times, abstaining unless there's mutual willingness between husband and wife. See that the it's what it is that you have is the restraining and the channeling and the, what would you call, reining in, maybe, of human sexual desires in such a way that it elevates it above the animal-like and elevates the life of Israel again and the life of families. How about the Sabbath? That also has something to do with holiness. Sabbath means one day is holy, one day is different. In Judaism, any classical teacher would say anyone who doesn't have a Sabbath, for whom every day is the same, is living like an animal. I mean, to animals, every day is the same, right? Only humans are given this great gift of one day being different, being elevated, reflecting on the other six. So that's the kind of the heart of all of Sabbath laws. Same thing about festivals or feasts, holidays. And as I say, laws of holiness are not necessarily ethical or moral. To not observe the festivals isn't unethical, but it's unholy. It's not to participate in the sanctification or the setting apart of a certain period of time. Rabbi Abraham Heschel said, every people has understood how to make holy spaces, how to make spaces sanctified. We understand that, you know, churches, temples, whatever. All the pagans had temples. He said only Israel built a cathedral in time. Only Israel created holy time. Time that was different. Where you were in a different mode or in a different presence than normal time. So that has to do with holiness. And then finally, national laws. That's the fourth category of Torah laws. And these are laws primarily to identify with the Jewish nation and its past and its mission. And these are all the laws relating to festivals. There's massive amounts of laws relating to Passover, to Sukkoth, Hanukkah, not so much Purim and Yom Kippur. Those are, well, Yom Kippur, but Purim is later. Does anyone know what Hanukkah is all about? Just by the way, it's very late. 165 BC, the Greeks ruled Palestine, and they were very cruel, and they treated the people horribly. If a woman had her baby boy circumcised, they killed the child and hung the child around the mother's neck. This is what the Greeks, they were the Seleucids, Antiochus IV. And they tried to eradicate, it was the first systematic attempt to eradicate Judaism. Okay. And it was forbidden to have the Bible, to possess it, etc. Anyway, a bunch of people led by a man named Judah Maccabee, Judah the Hammer, said, we've had enough. We're not putting up with this anymore. We're either going to get these Greeks out of here or we're going to die trying. And they were actually quite successful. And in 165 BC, they cleared out the temple and removed all the pagan desecrations in the temple. They threw off the yoke of the Greeks and declared some limited independence. And that's what Hanukkah commemorates. It's actually not a festival that Jews through history have been really excited about or proud of. It's kind of a bloody thing. It's only become important in recent time. Why?
because of an alternative to Christmas. Before that, it really was not that big. Purim is much more important. The story commemorates when Esther saved her people from genocide in the book of Esther. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the holiest day of the year. And in more recent times, in many Jewish circles, there is a Yom HaShoah, a day to commemorate the Holocaust. Some of you may be aware of that. And there are other laws about aiding fellow Jews, and that applies today as any time. There have been, still a need to help Russian Jews to get out of there. The Ethiopian airlift, whatever it may be. Things that identify with the Jewish nation, its past and its mission. All right, very quickly, I'm going to do the Sabbath thing, but not the dietary law. I'll save that for tomorrow, which is point number 8. I'm going to give you an example of a large complex of Torah law that falls actually into all 4 categories. Any given commandment or statute or ordinance falls into at least 2 of these 4 categories that I've given you. There are none that fall in only one. I'm making it more complicated than that. I've talked about reflexive, ethical, holiness, and national. But any given commandment or ordinance has to do with at least 2 of those categories. Sabbath laws have to do with all 4, and here's why. The Sabbath is a day of peace on earth. First of all, it's a day for peace within people. In other words, it affects people who keep the Sabbath. Now, you don't do business, you don't work for gain, you don't handle money, so you're not even tempted to do so. You use no external sources of energy. What you do is you return to yourself as a source of creativity for one day. You are liberated for one day from the dependence on technology. And for one day, you have time to reflect on why you worked for 6 days. And that's the reflexive dimension of Sabbath laws. It doesn't do anything to anyone else. It does something to you. You, the observer of those Sabbath commandments. Okay? Secondly, it's a day of peace between people. There are Sabbath laws about family, about companionship, requiring that people come together and grow in relationships. And it's not just being together, but a different kind of talking, holy conversation. You don't talk about the same things on the Sabbath. You don't talk about laundry and diapers and whatever, blah, blah, blah. You talk about the Bible. You read the Bible. You talk about God. You talk about something that's a little more elevated or different, set apart from how you talk the other times. There's a family focus, learning together, not just living together. The Sabbath table is really, somebody said to me, well, where's the altar in Judaism? And I said, it's the table in the kitchen. Judaism is really a religion based in the home. There it is where it happens. And you gather around that table, family, learning together, not just living together. And another law that really I find touching is the law that in a Jewish community, single people may never be allowed to spend the Sabbath day alone. Okay? So in observant Jewish communities, there will always be non-family members at the table so they can be part of the family and experience what it is to be Israel on the Day of Peace. And those are ethical dimensions of Sabbath that have to do with relationships between people. I talked to you already about the laws about your animals on the Sabbath, which are also ethical. Because there are laws also concerning slaves and servants that they cannot be made to work on the Sabbath. All right. Peace between people and nature. This is also somewhat ethical. An important part of the Sabbath is not dominating nature. In other words, for 6 days, people tamper with and dominate and use nature. One day you declare a truce and you leave nature alone. Okay? So that's why you don't start a fire. You don't tamper with nature. You don't create or destroy on that day. That's why there's a debate among observant Jews about cars. It's nothing fancy, it's just because of the spark plugs they make fire. Okay? And then finally, there are holiness aspects of the Sabbath. Peace between people and God. A day of peace between people and God. They're not ethical laws, but they affect one's relationship with God. Things like the commandments to pray, to study the Bible, to set aside the day for such things, to devote oneself to spiritual, not material concerns, and relate for a day to the one who has no body and no matter. To leave the material world for a day and spend some time with the one who is the eternal. Leave the temporal and spend some time with the eternal, I guess, is the way I'd like to say it. Now that's a holiness aspect. That has to do with one's growth in relationship with God. So those are holiness aspects. And I could have even added there are national aspects of the Sabbath as well, but I'll just let you sort of figure that out. Celebrating or observing the Sabbath together binds the larger community together as well. It binds Israel together. All Israel is doing the same thing on that day, at least theoretically. Tomorrow, I'll talk about dietary law, kashrut, and the way that dietary laws fall into all four of the categories as well. But I'd like now to have question and answer time. I'd like you to reflect on this. Is this new information to you? Does it surprise you? Does it fit in with anything you've experienced or not fit in with what you've experienced? This is the second pillar, so to speak, of what makes Judaism Judaism. And again, I talked about how even the word Judaism is a little bit inaccurate, because there is no such thing. There's no coherent system or institution or structure among Jews, like a church. You know, Christians tend to think of Judaism as a church for Jews, but it's not a church. It doesn't have the same kind of institutional structure. It's very decentralized. People do this and that here and there and everywhere. And so, you know, among Jews, I wouldn't even use the word Judaism. And somebody asked me yesterday, well, then what would Jews call it? And I'd say, well, they would just call it Torah, you know, or Israel or something. I mean, they wouldn't even use the word Judaism because it's not a system. It's not an ism, you know, in that sense. And of course, somebody also asked, well, you know, all Jews aren't observant, you know, don't observe the commandments. That's true. That's true. I said, to be a Jew, you only had to adhere to one of these. You know, and it's even in a very tense, you know, maybe a very marginal way. But there are three denominations in North America, groupings of Jews, and one is Orthodox, the smallest group, less than 10%, and those are people who are rather stringent about observing commandments. Although it's kind of a Christian misconception of Orthodox Jews that they're all real legalistic about laws. The Hasidim, who wear the black hats, they're actually very free. They're not legalistic at all. They like to dance and celebrate, and they observe, but you know they're not really too hard-nosed about it. Even those people. And then the other two denominations in Judaism are Reform Judaism, which is the most liberal and probably has the least number of people who observe commandments, you know, who observe dietary law and Sabbath law and all that. The Reform movement was a movement that came out of Germany in the 19th century. It was started as an alternative to Orthodoxy. There was a German rabbi who said, you know, it shouldn't be that either you're Orthodox or you're not Jewish. There should be another way to be Jewish and to be committed to Israel and so forth. And that's resulted in Reform Judaism. It was kind of a movement. It was very big in America in the last century. And the third denomination, which is now the largest Jewish denomination in America, is called Conservative. And what conservative is kind of in between. a lot of conservative Jews do observe and do, you know, observe dietary law and other things. It was kind of a reaction to reform in America. It's really an American phenomenon. Jews in America who weren't Orthodox, but who really felt that reform was way too liberal and to the point of not even being Jewish anymore, and said, you know, we're going to be more serious, but we're not going to be Orthodox. And that's called conservative Judaism. And but it's changing all the time. They said that, I read something that 25 years ago, less than 2% of Reform rabbis kept kosher. And last year, over 50% of Reform rabbis kept kosher. So Jews in America are starting more and more to observe, to be more observant rather than less. Many Jews in North America are realizing, what's the point of being Jewish if we don't observe Torah? I mean, that's really, and that, again, that shows you, it's Judaism is not based on doctrines, beliefs, ideas. It's based on life. It's based on a way of living day by day. Okay, I'd like to open it up to any of your questions, reflections, stuff that confused you.
Values. It's been my understanding that Jewish people really, I don't know, I think this may be different, value the mind and what it can do.
Yeah.
And so when I heard you say behavioral, I mean behavioral and as opposed, or did I say behavior? What about the inner? Not the inner. What'd you say?
Go on, keep going. Okay, let's talk about that.
But the mind.
Why among Jews is there such a high level of learning? Well, I would argue that it's because of Judaism, because of Torah, and a whole complex of Torah commands involve study. It's a commandment to study the Bible, to study the Talmud. You know, to get to know the tradition, to read what the rabbis have said in the past. It's a commandment. So in a home or in a community that is really focused on study, what happens? Well, people have a high literacy rate. They learn to read. And in most cases, Jews are in exile, so they know at least two languages, Hebrew and, you know, that they use at home and in the synagogue, and then the language and their culture. So what am I saying? People grow in their powers of mind and of study. So it's no accident that then Jews have gone and studied other things. Okay. It is really a way of life rooted on study. So that's why that happens. However, I would say the focus of study in Judaism is not on doctrines and beliefs and the way that kind of Christians study theology. It's more a study of traditions, a study of conversations and disputations about Torah laws, maybe, between different rabbis. The focus of the study is not, it's not so abstract. When you talk to Jews about, you know, if you say, well, what's your theology of something? They kind of look at you like, well, you know, we don't do theology like you do, like you Christians do. We don't try to integrate it with all kinds of philosophical systems, or at least most Jewish scholars don't. Okay? It's more based on, it's related to, again, the fabric of life as Israel. So I hope that answers your question.
Well, yeah, and also just a statement that I observed that Jews believe in the power of the mind more than some other groups. The power of the mind.
I have to explore that.
Okay.
Because you'd have to say now if you're talking about secular Jews or observant Jews.
Probably so.
Because observant Jews pretty much believe in the power of Torah.
Yeah, right.
Much more than an individual's
secular
mind.
Yeah.
Well, did I understand you to say that Judaism emphasizes values more than cerebral ability? But then you were talking about intelligence.
Yeah. It emphasizes actions and values. But it contends, I believe, that actions shape your values much more than values shape actions. In other words, by learning to treat animals
with respect,
for example, and we'll talk about this tomorrow, a kosher animal that by type is kosher may not be kosher if it's not killed instantly with one cut of a sharp knife, because the idea is to not subject the animal to any needless suffering. Okay, now, if people learn to do that, and children from childhood learn to think about treating animals that way, the contention is that it'll shape their values, and they'll end up with values of compassion, of respect, of, murder rates in Jewish communities are very low. They're extremely low. I mean, if you heard that somebody committed murder and there was a Jew, you'd be real, I mean, Jews especially would be really surprised. It's very, very, very unusual. And again, the idea is that behavior shapes values much more than the other way around. I mean, Jews look at Christians and they say, you're talking about values all the time, and you're philosophizing about them, you're writing them down all over, but what, it doesn't seem to change anything. The values don't seem to issue in behavior. And they say, we do it the other way. Behavior results in values. It's a basic idea of virtue or character, that if you do something, you're prone to do it again. The doing of it actually shapes you and makes you more likely to do that same thing again and less likely to do something else. If you steal, you're more likely to steal again. If you do good, you're more likely to do good again and to not steal. So, if you don't steal when you're given the opportunity, then the next time it'll be more likely again that you won't, etc.
Read today's newspaper, everything.
I don't know if these two words have any meaning or not in regard to the context of this, but so many times, in our country, so much is individualistic rather than corporate.
Yes. Yes.
And I remember some time ago we had a bishop from Tanzania who spoke. I think it was Tanzania. I'm not sure of that. He talked about the community in which he lived, mm-hmm. and that the children were the property of the community, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and that everybody was concerned about mm-hmm. the children. It wasn't just, if one child did something wrong,
right?
Tough. It's that family's problem. No, it's my problem too.
That's right. Yes. Religious Judaism is always in a conflict in modern Western culture, in North America especially, because we do live in a very individualistic culture. We see ethics, especially in terms of individual decisions and individual behavior. But Torah is very communal. No Torah laws are ever addressed to individuals. None. There's none. They're only addressed to the community as a whole.
Yeah.
And there's no sense in, if you read through the Old Testament, you'll see, it never says that certain people were obedient or disobedient, faithful or unfaithful. It says Israel was faithful or unfaithful, you see? And it always addresses the whole community. And it's true, in traditional Jewish communities, the community does take care of the young. All the festivals, anyone been to a Jewish wedding? I mean, what a Jewish wedding does is it makes the man and the woman into like mythical figures, Adam and Eve again, and you're in the garden and be fruitful and multiply and the whole thing about children, and it just ties the whole community together, and everybody has a vested interest in that marriage. You see, they're not seen as this couple off by themselves with children off by themselves. They're in this context of family ties and a larger community. And again, that's part of the spirit of Torah, is that a community is necessary for this whole thing to work. The whole contention, I would argue, of Torah is that if there isn't a group of people that you're accountable to, you probably won't do it. You probably won't observe the commandments unless there's people there to say to you, hey, what are you doing? To whom you can be accountable. And you're right to point out that not all places in the church throughout the world are as individualistic as our place. It has more to do with our culture than with the church. Yeah, African churches are much more communal. You bet. I mean, when you're baptized, it isn't just a matter between you and God, it's a matter between you and God and all these people.
Well, I was wondering about, if when a Jewish person dies, you know, what's their idea of that and afterlife and so forth?
Interesting. That's a very good question. There are a lot of ways to answer it. She asked, what about death? What about the afterlife? In the Old Testament, you'll find a word called Sheol. So if we go way back, you know, to the origins of Judaism, you've got Sheol. And what Sheol is, it's just the place of the dead. It's the place where all the dead go. And it's kind of a place of just nothingness. Just nothing. Just non-being, I guess. A place of darkness. You know, in the Psalms, it often says, don't let me go down into the pit. Don't let me go down into Sheol. It just means the place of the dead. Don't let me die. But there's just a sense of life ends and you go back to dust and you're in Sheol. Now later, in later Judaism, especially between the Testaments, like the 3 centuries before Jesus' time, there became a lot more talk and interest in the afterlife and in resurrection. And when we come to Jesus' time, you have the Sadducees, who are really the old arch-conservatives. They only accept the first 5 books of the Bible, nothing else. And they cling to the old idea of Sheol. So they say no resurrection from the dead. The Pharisees, on the other hand, were the liberals. They were the innovators. They were the ones who were willing to adapt and change with the times and so forth. And the Pharisees said they were more in tune with some of the more modern stuff. And they said they talked about the resurrection of the dead. Things like, they looked at things like Ezekiel and the bones. And that's the first real vision of resurrection of the dead. See. So the Pharisees definitely believe in a life beyond for the righteous. And of course, as you know, the Judaism of the Sadducees died because it was focused on the temple. 70 AD, the temple's destroyed. Their version of Judaism is dead. The only version of Judaism that was able to live was the liberal one that could adapt. So when the people got exiled and scattered all over the place, they could adjust. Now the Judaism of the Pharisees is actually the Judaism that we know today because it's the only kind that could survive away from the temple, you know, away from the sacrifices, etc., etc. And they did definitely. And subsequent Judaism then does affirm the resurrection. When Messiah comes, resurrection, return to Israel, to Zion, you know, that glorious vision of Isaiah 11. That's basically how religious Jews would be waiting for that, the age to come.
A person to think that call of Jews, I don't know if that's right, believe in sin?
The Jews believe in sin. Yes. But they don't believe in original sin like Christians have. The Jewish view of the human person is pretty down to earth. There's a Yetzer Hara and a Yetzer Hatov. There's an inclination in each person to evil. And there's an inclination in each person to good. And that's the basic Jewish view of the human person. You have an inclination in you to evil, and you have an inclination to good. And the whole process of growing as a human being and growing in goodness is to learn to let that inclination to good be expressed and the inclination to evil to work to restrain it. So is that sin? Yeah, sinful and good. See? The Christian doctrine of original sin that comes from Augustine and Luther and so forth is much darker. You know, it's much more focused on the tendency toward evil and suggests that people can't really do good, they can only do evil. And that's where Jews would differ. They would say, no, it's not inevitable. It's just possible to do either, and neither is inevitable. That's why you have Torah. So you grow in goodness. And you learn to desist from evil and do good.